למשל, במהלך האינתיפאדה הראשונה, כאן אהל ישראל חלק גדול מאוד מהאוכלוסייה הפלסטינית. כתוצאה מכך נוצרו בבתי הכלא רשתות חברתיות חזקות. רשתות שקידמו דוקטרינות פוליטיות וערכים חברתיים שחציפיים. קיומן של רשתות אלו השפיע על תחושותיהם של הילדים האסירים. הולדים חובות סייע להם לחזור לחברה לאחר שחרורן. האינתיפאדה הראשונה שינתה מהותית גם את הדימוי החברתי הקיים של הילדים, כי הם כבר מילאו תרגיל למאבק הגדול לשחרור הלאומי. בעוד שבעבר לא היה להם הרבה קול חברתי ופוליטי.
We once had a teacher, a teacher, old teacher. He changed the world for the better and made us a teacher.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher.
לפי איגוד הפסיכולוגים האמריקנים, מאזר בעינים הם חרידים למעגל ההוויה האנושית הרעילה.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners of IRIB English Radio welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher an analysis on the most important Islamic teachings I am Atal the host of this program Sheikh Danish and Sheikh Fadai two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom are in today's studio Assalamu alaikum Sheikh Danish welcome to the show
Assalamu alaikum thank you
and Sheikh Fadai Assalamu alaikum to you
So
how are you doing Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Danish How about you?
Thank you very much for accepting my invitation to the program, The Teacher. For today's discussion, we'll talk about Sakarat al-Maut. It is roughly translated into English as the agonies of death. It refers to the difficulties that come upon a dying person at the time of death.
Okay, so some people might say that when we are dead, our body is not going to feel anything. So why there must be some hardships or the agonies upon us, okay? What is the main reason? And scientifically speaking, can it be approved or not? That, for example, there are some agonies or hardships on the dead person.
Sheikh Fadai, let's start with you. So what does it refer to exactly, Sakarat al-Maut?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. You know, the one which feels is not the body, uh-huh. the soul.
Okay.
Even in this world, you know? When I, for example, touch a very hot, kettle or pot,
yes.
I feel that heat and I endure and I feel hardship, but the one which feels is not my fingers, it's my soul. The finger is instrument. Why do I say that? Imagine that, just think about the process of medical anesthesia. If you go to surgery room and they do that on your hands, and again, you just touch that pot or kettle, do you feel anything? No, because that instrument doesn't work. You know, the body is connected to the brain. The brain is the head of the body, body organs.
Okay.
And the brain is connected to the soul. The main boss, the main head, is the soul. Soul is the one who feels. Because of that, after the one is dead, he doesn't feel anything. Because this connection is caught. So, Sakarat al-Maut, when the one feels that, first of all, he's not dead, yet he's not dead. He's alive. He is dying in Sakarat al-Maut. And if it starts, according to our Rivayat, soul taking starts from the foot toes, the fingers of foot,
all right.
and ends to the head. And we have in Quran, فَلَوْلَا إِذَا بَلَغَتِ الْحُلْقُونَ When the soul taking reaches the throat, reaches.
It started
from
So it's coming from down to up, okay?
This connection But organ by organ, first of all the food, then the lining of the stomach, then up to the throat. And the reason is that even the last minutes of your life, you would have the opportunity to do this even the last second.
So it doesn't start with your mouth.
Yeah, it doesn't start with your mouth.
Okay.
So, you know, this connection, when it is caught, yes, after that, you don't feed. Yes, the body doesn't feel in the grave. But the head is alive. The bus is alive. The bus is soul.
Right.
Even in the grave, your soul, the one who used to feel in that in the previous world,
right,
now is feeling. But let alone the psychological mode, that the one is alive and is feeling everything by the soul.
Okay, that's it. Thank you. So, is psychological mount or the agonies of death for everyone, Chad? I mean, whether believer or disbeliever, we must experience death at the end of our life, okay? But is it going to be hard for everyone?
Right. So, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. As the brother mentioned, that it is a part that when a person goes from this stage of this worldly life to the other world, it is a difficult process. But in the riwayas and the traditions, it has been mentioned that for the believers, it is like smelling a flower, right? A flower, when you smell it, it's sweet and it's the smell is fragrant. But for the disbeliever, it is like divine punishment. And even for some believers who are going to be punished by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or who have certain acts that that have not been purified through their istighfar and they're seeking tawbah from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they are going to suffer some punishment during the process of their souls being taken to the other world. And so we have this verse of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Kahf, verse number 19, which speaks about specifically the process of Sakarat al-Mawt. And it says that Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, وَجَاءَتْ سَكَرَةُ الْمَوْتِ بِالْحَقِّ ذَلِكَ مَا كُنْتَ مِنْهُ تَحْسِينَ. The verse says, then the agony of death brings the truth. This is what you used to shun. That is, it's speaking to everyone. That for everyone, there is a difficulty in the process of giving death. But we have from the traditions, we know that the good people, the prophets, the a'imma alayhimus salam, and the noble ones are going to be given an easy passage. Right? But what will happen? وَنُفِقَ فِي السُّورِ ذَلِكَ يَوْمُ الْوَعِيدِ وَجَاءَتْ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَعَهَا سَائِقٌ وَشَهِيدٌ لَقَدْ كُنْتَ فِي غَفْلَةٍ مِنْ هَذَا فَكَشَفْنَا عَنْكَ غِطَاءَكَ فَبَصَرُكَ الْيَوْمَ حَدِيدٌ. So this entire process of veil being taken off your eyes. So because you are going into another stage in your life, those veils will be taken away from your eyes, and you will be able to see realities as they truly are. And so it entails a sort of difficulty. Sakarat al-Mawt, the literal meaning is that it is a sort of intoxication. Sakara, the literal meaning is intoxication.
That's right.
Yes, because of the huge pain that people will suffer at this stage, it makes their bodies intoxicated. It seems that numb. Yes,
that's right, okay.
Numb,
that's right,
from the pain. And so
from the pain, that's right.
Huge pain,
okay.
And this Quranic terminology is basically highlighting the same concept.
That's it, okay.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
So, Sheikh Fadai, are there any actions to do by some other people rather than yourself, okay? For example, the people who are burying you or something like that.
to make this stage an easier way for you?
Of course.
For example, your parents, your wife, your children, something like that.
We have some advice in our revayas. For example, we are told to recite Quran. The one is dying. Sometimes it is clear for us that the one is dying. These are the last moments. It's better to recite Quran in front of him, besides him, or put Quran on his chest, and the one is dying. These are the words that attract the kinds of kindness of the angel of death. When the angel is taking the soul of this one, organ by organ, and maybe it is supposed to be hard for him, or talk about that one should be hard, when it is supposed to be hard because of his previous action, but by some action, like reciting Quran, like putting Quran, this one, this angel, will be more kinder with him. And just think about some of the actions that nowadays we see in some cemeteries, playing music.
Wow. I watch it too.
No, okay. you're not helping him.
Okay.
You're just harming him.
By playing music or dancing or something like that. Okay.
No, we are not told to do that.
All right. We are not recommended.
Now he is dying in this world. You should help him. You just have it on for yourself.
All right.
And so the question, the main question is that why? I want to answer this question. Second, why Sakarat Hamal? Why should we experience this kind of sakura or this special hardness, hardship? So, answer is that imagine a surgery. If the one has a tumor in the brain, I don't know, or in his stomach,
yes.
So when he needs a surgery, and the surgery will be harder when the tumor is bigger. The bigger tumor, the harder surgery.
All right.
That tumor is our sins. When I gathered a lot of sins, these like gathering a lot of viruses or infections in my body.
All right.
You know, we are gathering and collecting a lot of viruses and dirt and infection in our souls.
That's right.
Making that to a tumor. And when we are dying, the surgery starts.
All right.
That tumor should be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
So because you made that tumor bigger, so your surgery should be harder.
Why
not?
Okay.
We shouldn't complain. You know, the one, the angel, is taking my soul harder than the other one.
All right.
Like the doctor who cut the stomach or cut the brain or skull of that one harder and more. You know, the doctor is not brutal. The doctor is kind.
Yes.
Doctor is helping him.
Yes.
The problem is from himself.
All right.
He didn't care about his health.
Mm-hmm.
So that is physical health. And now we're talking about spiritual health. So heart sakarat al-maut is because of our sins. And God is cleaning us by that hardship. Yes. We can think now, we can start. We can think about our death. And now the time that we can make it easy.
Okay.
Not at that time.
Especially for those who are very much attached to the materialistic world, leaving this world will be a very difficult one, okay? So because the soul is very much connected and affiliated with the mundane world, materialistic world, you know, the love for these attachments in this world.
As much as you make this connection stronger, cutting this connection,
cutting so difficult.
It's like that. Not make it so strong. Yes, we are connected to material world, but use it as it's necessary.
Okay.
As much as it's necessary.
Yes.
Do not make it stronger than necessary.
So a spirit can be connected to materialistic world too. I mean, because when we are talking about materialistic, we are talking about physical things. But the spirit can have roots in the materialistic world too, to be connected very much, so that separating the two will be
like different kinds of glue.
Uh-huh.
You want to attach something to other things.
All right.
What kind of glue you use?
Are you using? That's right.
Yes. When the glue is harder, cutting this connection will be harder. Soul and body is like that.
Okay, that's it. So, Shaykh Danish, now, one of the major questions is that, are there any deeds deeds we must do in order to make our, we can say, separation from this world or the time of death a little bit easier for us?
Yes, in fact, in the riwayas, a lot of good deeds have been mentioned that make it easier for a person to die peacefully or the, not feel the same level or amount of pain. So from the riwayas, we can say that Sile-e-Rahim, meeting and doing good to your relatives, having a constant connection with your relatives is mentioned. Your good deeds towards your parents, your mother and your father. Even in one of the riwayas, it is mentioned that if a person's mother is not pleased with him and is not happy with that person, they will have a difficulty in giving and detaching themselves from this world. Then we have love for Imam Ali alayhi salam. Love for Imam Ali alayhi salam is going to make it easy for a person, the believer, to die peacefully. Then going a lot for the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, or even performing the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam has been mentioned. So all of these good deeds, we see that a lot of them is about hukuk al-nas, right? Or hukuk al-imam. And because we say that hukukullah may be forgiven, but hukukunnas is what is going to be difficult for a person without the permission of that person. So the most important people after the Aima alayhi salam are our parents.
Yes.
And so if we are respectful towards our parents, we perform the duties we owe them, it is going to make it easier for us to part from this world. Even some of the surahs of the Holy Quran have been mentioned. Suratul Yasin, Surah Yasin has been mentioned in the riwayas. Surah Safat specifically has been mentioned from Imam Al-Kazim alayhi salam, who says that reciting Surah Safat near a person who is going to or is feeling the Sakarat al-Maut is going to ease his pain. And so all of these are basically a connection from this world to the other world and have been narrated to us in the riwayah.
You know, there's a riwayah from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam that Shaykh al-Mufid narrated that once a young person was dying, he was in Sakarat al-Maut. And it was very hard for him. You know, my brother mentioned the riwayah of parents,
that's right.
Remember that they asked Prophet to be beside that person in order to have an easier death.
Kind of death, that's right.
But Prophet was watching him that it was very hard for him.
Right.
Prophet told him, say La ilaha illallah. He couldn't say. And repeated that. He couldn't say. The Prophet asked him, does he have any mother? The mother is alive or not? They said, yes, he does. Prophet said, go and bring the mother. They brought the mother and Prophet asked him, are you satisfied with him? The mother said, no. He was not good with me. Because of that, the mouth was so hard for him.
Wow.
Prophet asked him, forgive your son.
Ask her, that's
yes,
fine.
Ask her, the mother, forgive the son. After she, the mother, forgave the child just because of Prophet. Just for the respect of Prophet, she forgave the son. She could die very easily. The second amount was taken from him. That is the position and the status of our parents. Affecting on our death.
That's right. Respect the parents, kiss the hands of your mothers, kiss the feet of your father. This is what mentioned, you know, in Kitab Jamo Saadat by the late Nawawi, that if your mother is dissatisfied with you, Sakarat al-Maut would be really difficult for you, okay? So mother has great status in your life, okay? So, and make them happy, inshallah, and go to your mothers, you know, and kiss their hands and let them be happy with you, inshallah. You will have easier time of death. So this is mother. Thank you very much, Shaykh Fadai, Shaykh Danish, for a nice elaboration regarding Sakarat al-Maut. It was very kind. Thank you much, dear listeners. For any information or more information, please visit our website, iranradio.ir. Also send us your questions and comments at iranradio@sinairabi.ir email. So till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. La ilaha illallah.
Every day is a lesson, and everything you do finds yourself. Now I know we all have good intentions.
is known for its voices, its climate, and the climatic variety that each of its regions. This time, the lavender fields of North Khorasan Province have invited us so that we could discover a part of natural beauty in northeastern Iran.
The land of a thousand colors, with a wild and vibrant nature, where kings and poets have been inspired by its beauties throughout the ages. A place where fountains keep the rivers flowing like the never-ending tale of Shahrazad in the 1,000 Nights and the Night.
From some of the most arid deserts in the world, the habitat is the Iranian cheetah, to the greenest forests, pastures, and valleys, North Khorasan has it all. Here at the Baba Amon Forest Park, the combination of rivers, waterfalls, and the umbrella of sycamore trees have all created one of the most popular summer hideouts for the people in the region.
There are a number of forest parks in North Khorasan, and Baba Amon is one of the popular ones. In spring and summer, Baba Amon hosts the largest number of visitors. At first sight, the place resembles an oasis. What greets you here upon your arrival is the cool, gentle breeze that touches your face. The symphony of the flowing river and the terraced ponds in the middle of the park complete this good feeling. But our trip to North Khorasan is not all about nature. In this amazing region of Iran, there is a little town which could be considered unique, at least in Iran and its surrounding countries. The exceptional feature of this place unveils itself after a short drive in the town's own boulevard.
We have come to a little town in northeast Iran, a town with only 12,000 inhabitants. What is interesting about it is that it has more than 170 shops that only sell dried nuts and dried snacks, such as cash. It's a combination of dried herbs and herbs and spices. Wow. It's kind of hard, but it's so tasty.
Welcome to Faruj, the region's trade hub for dried nuts, trail mixes, and you name it.
Is its untouched natural environment. Many believe that this region could be one of the main destinations for ecotourism in the near future. A few kilometers from the city of Shirvan, the village known as Yeliyah testifies to this fact.
We head towards a hidden paradise in Iran's northeast. Yeliyan, also known as Golyan, is one of the 365 outstanding tourist villages in Iran. With a population of no more than 700, the inhabitants of this picturesque mountainous area are mainly engaged in farming and animal husbandry. Yeliyan is situated in a valley. The terraced structure of the village and its adobe buildings along with very tall trees are only some of the interesting features of this place. Some people believe that if you're born in Iran and spend an entire lifetime traveling across this country, you still need to be able to see all the beauties of ancient lands. This may be true, but seeing at least a part of beautiful Iran is still worth it.
We will be talking about this. Israel's near daily airstrikes on Lebanon, which have killed many civilians despite a ceasefire, face a heightened fears of a wider war. Baker warns that a full-scale Israeli attack would be imminent as regional and international actors have sounded the alarm as well. Analysts caution that with outreach and diplomacy, the confrontation could spiral into regional devastation.
Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country. Youssef Raji said Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for a large-scale military operation against Lebanon. He said Lebanon is intensifying diplomatic contacts to shield the country and its vital facilities from the potential strikes. The remarks come in the wake of a fresh round of Israeli airstrikes on Lebanese soil. On Friday, regime's warplanes carried out at least a dozen attacks across the country. The regime claimed that the attacks targeted Hezbollah sites and rocket launchers. However, witnesses said the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Despite the ceasefire agreement signed between Israel and Lebanon in November 2024, Israeli airstrikes have continued almost daily, with little respite. The regime also maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon. This persistent aggression has sparked international condemnation, particularly from the United Nations. A UN report published this month revealed that at least 127 Lebanese civilians, including children, have been killed since the ceasefire took effect. The UN has characterized these ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. Many believe that the attacks aim at pressuring Hezbollah movement to lay down its arms and reach a new deal with the Lebanese government. However, the group has ruled out any new agreement with Israel, saying that intimidation will not change Hezbollah's stance of resistance. It says U.S. and Israel's calls for disarmament are designed to weaken Lebanon and leave it exposed to external aggression. Analysts warn that the escalating confrontation risks plunging the region into a wider conflict with devastating consequences. For now, Lebanon's leadership and resistance insist that only diplomacy and international pressure can avert a full-scale war.
And we also have journalist and political commentator Leila Hatoum. Welcome to the program. To both my guests, let's start off with Ms. Hatoum in Beirut. Now, Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of an imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country, and that Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for this large-scale military operation. Why is the Israeli regime continuing to seek escalation while it's in a supposed ceasefire with Lebanon?
You have to understand one thing. When the Israelis threaten, that means they're not going to do any action. When they want to do action, they dare to do it. So the escalation that we've been seeing over the past 11 months along our border, since the signing of this, actually it's been a year, since the cessation of hostilities agreement between Lebanon and the Israeli occupation, the Israelis have been reaching it on a daily basis. 2 months ago, they said that they're going to escalate their aggression against Lebanon, and they didn't care, and this is what they did. Daily aggressions. In fact, less than 2 hours ago, before I came over to the studio, the Israeli occupation opened fire through one of their brigades against one of our vessels called fishermen's boat, and then they threw a sound grenade against one of the fishermen in his boat in the sea on the coast of Ras al-Makura, that's basically southern Lebanon's coastal sector. So having said that, the Israelis, nothing which stops them if they want to do something. When they threaten openly, it means they are not going to do anything, and they're trying to create pressure, fear-mongering, to push the Lebanese towards either trying to disarm the resistance or put more pressure on the resistance internally so that the resistance doesn't do any action. Also, you have to remember another thing. The Israelis don't fight during winter time. That's why most of the agreements happen around the month of October or November, because they don't fight during December and January. You just look throughout their history. They can't do a widespread escalation on the ground during winter time. So what they can do is that they continue to bombard us by 4 days, and this is what they're doing on daily basis.
All right, let's bring in Mr. Major as well. Major Israeli jets have recently carried out more than a dozen strikes in South Lebanon. The Israeli military claims that they have swept Chinese sites, but witnesses say that the strikes hit civilian sites in open fields. Now, in that regard, the Hezbollah chief just last week said Israeli attacks have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons, and rather it's the expansionist regime seeking to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and initiating the Greater Israel project through the Lebanese front. Do you see in that light as well?
Sense of that conclusion. Israel's got the Zionist project and the built-in DNA of expansionism, of appropriating more and more territory. Some of them are talking about the founding of Syria and seizing the land that they built and incorporating the land that they seized into the Israeli state as they did back in the world. So this expansionism is nothing new.
The cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed on the 26th of November 2024 and came into effect on November 27th, 2024 and then before it came into effect around January 26th, 2025 hasn't been respected by the Israeli occupation since then until today. More than 5,000 breaches of that cessation of hostilities on part of the Israeli occupation had been witnessed and documented even by the United Nations Supreme Forces in South Lebanon. So basically we cannot rely on these guarantors to get us anywhere. But it comes to international diplomacy, we also have to understand one thing, that international diplomacy has done nothing for Lebanon since 1948 until today. So the Israeli occupation continued to occupy the Eastern Israel, not from 1948, but actually from 1945 until 5 parts of the new outskirts of Jenin and they started building their basically the Kaaba and put them in among other things. So, having looked into this whole situation, it's good also that the Israelis respect and also to say that the Muslims for agreements or even the armistice agreement that we signed with them in 1949. The Israelis breached it seven times between 1949 and 1967 before the Israelis themselves actually targeted Lebanon, occupied most of its southern part in the 1967 war, which Lebanon had no hand in. The Israelis were fighting with the Jordanians, the Syrians, and the Egyptians at the time. Lebanon had no hand in that war until they actually targeted Lebanon, which was the first time to sign an armistice agreement. Since then, until today, the Israelis continue to address Lebanon. International diplomacy does nothing. By 2006, we agreed, both parties agreed to the 1701 UN Security Council resolution. The Israelis should have actually withdrawn from southern Lebanese territory, but they didn't. They continued to breach that resolution nearly 3,000 times between 2006 and 2023, until this war was called aggression on Lebanon and the apartheid started. It's a full-scale war and war crime against Lebanon. So again, if the international guarantors are not going to respect their word, and they haven't shown us any example in the past to respect their word, if the Israelis are not going to respect their word, and that shows us throughout history that they never respected any of the agreements we signed with them, then basically they have no other choice. When it comes to the leadership of the resistance, as well as the Lebanese leadership, thinking about the president himself, they have the same point. The Israelis have to withdraw from Lebanon and stop threatening us and stop targeting us. Otherwise, resistance is our natural right on the Lebanese.
Nick Napier, the United Nations has characterized the ongoing strikes as potentially war crimes. We know last week the Lebanese president met with a delegation from the Security Council in Beirut, urging the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and withdraw from Lebanon. Apparently that didn't work. So the UN has done nothing with regards to any of the Israeli violations in Lebanon, also the daily massacres in Gaza. How does this reflect on the credibility of the UN when it seems so helpless in the face of Israeli violations?
When the UN and even the US would condemn Israel, forget to remember the UN at the moment. In the 60s or 70s, when the Palestinians hijacked and bring the red flag, Israel attacked the UN and destroyed the Lebanese civilians. But they didn't do anything about it, they didn't impose any sanctions. But today, When a UN committee was coming to the city and dropped upon an Arab capital occupied by the Israeli military shortly before the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, a UN committee came to the city and the Israeli military on that day shelled the center of Beirut with high explosive shells, killing a lot of people. And the Israeli newspapers understood the joke. They shelled the city at 2:42, 18:03, and 3:38. The numbers of the UN resolution attempted to constrain Israeli terminology. And the Israeli newspaper said, yes, the joke is obvious. So Israel has demonstrated its contempt for the United Nations in Lebanese blood. by massacring people in order to send a message. So it seems to me when you look at the record, no crime is the devastation of Dahiya. The Israelis openly talking about the Dahiya doctrine. This is what they will enforce if they have to go on television. And all these other examples of extreme criminality and contempt for the United Nations. That tells us what Israel thinks of the
When I tune on the issue of the disarmament of the Lebanese resistance, we know the Israeli regime maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon, occupying those regions. You just mentioned earlier that the government should be focused more on issues like ending the Israeli occupation and regime's daily attacks. So why is the Lebanese government pursuing such a self-harming path? And who would actually benefit from Hezbollah's disarmament?
Well, unfortunately for us, the Lebanese government is inactive and it's unwilling to confront the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, we have some elements in main positions inside the government who are adamant at relinquishing Lebanon's right to resist, despite the fact that it has been assured to every population and country in this world under international law. So at the end of the day, when you look at the situation, we do have some elements that kind of what you call execute an Israeli-American agenda in Lebanon, and then they claim it's under what you call trying to maintain Lebanon's sovereignty. In that sense, when you have our foreign affairs minister going out, all out and about to justify the Israeli occupation's aggression on Lebanon, and that happened a few months back, and everybody had criticized him on that, it means that he is complicit one way or another, even as a foreign affairs minister, in terms of giving the Israelis the upper hand to use his words against Lebanon. I have never seen a minister throughout history, unless they were appointed by an occupation, justify for the occupation the what you call atrocities and war crimes committed against his own people. So at the end of the day, when I look at what's happening on the ground, the government is facilitating continued Israeli aggressions on Lebanon by not arming the Lebanese army, or at least using diplomacy, as they call it. If they think that diplomacy is going to work out, work wonders for them, why don't they use diplomacy to arm the Lebanese army? We heard the Americans very loud and clear through their envoy to the region and basically their ambassador in Turkey, Tom Barak, when he said, we're not going to arm the Lebanese army to fight the Israelis. We want to arm it to fight its own people and disarm the resistance. So at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, I do believe that the government, this government at least, will not be able to do anything. It's a transitional government. They will not be able to disarm the resistance for a reason. The resistance will not lay down its arms so long that there's an occupation. The president himself, who has very what you call mitigated decisions, not decisions but positions at certain points, he was very adamant and clear when he said that we cannot achieve peace so long that the Israeli occupation continues to occupy Lebanese territories and continue to address the Lebanese.
Nick Napier, about the greater Israel scheme, Benjamin Netanyahu and many other right-wing ministers have openly talked about the quote-unquote vision of a greater Israel. They constantly brag about the expansionist project. What does this mean, not just for Palestinians, but for the entire region? And who are the main obstacles to an Israeli occupation spanning across West Asia?
The Israelis have made abundantly clear they don't see the current borders of so-called Israel as in any way permanent. They're only a temporary thing to be expanded going forward. But you know, they cannot even attempt this without the U.S. backing. You know, a separate colonial project like the Jewish supremacist state in Palestine, it necessarily is at war with its neighbors. Because they're killing Arabs in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, because they are Arabs. And, you know, that doesn't play well with the people in neighbouring societies, neighbouring countries. So it's got a built-in instability where there's inevitably hatred and anger towards Israel. But that's not allowed to come out of the local government's impotence. But it's a permanent situation. If you look at South Africa, for example, before white supremacy was defeated, they devastated neighbouring countries.
Angola, Mozambique, Indonesia, and so on, because they had to do something before they had to be here. And I think it's the lesson of history is, for the people of the region, there's a terrible fight for the Zionist project until it is defeated and put in the dustbin of history. So the lessons are there, and I think this is also coloured by their need to accept what they call their deterrent edge. That means they have to be able to terrorise all their neighbours with the conclusion that they cannot resist the Israeli government. And because they failed to exterminate the citizens in Gaza, which is absolutely astonishing, because they actually failed in their war aims, and they failed to defeat the enemy, they failed to defeat the they feel like a need. But remember, there are 6 or 7 million people in Israel-Palestine at the moment. They're surrounded by 600 million people who can see what's going on. In order for them to survive, they need terror. State terror, continuous and unending state terror. And that will be the reality. I'm afraid that people are in Palestine, Jordan, and Syria, and Iraq, and Yemen, as long as the Zionist project continues with an airlift from Clinton, search and bombs, money, and so on.
The so-called Greater Israel map includes Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and in some illustrations, Saudi Arabia and even Kuwait. How has the silence and lack of proper action and outrage from other Arab countries further emboldened the Israelis? Who's to say that the Israelis won't set their sights on more Arab land in the future?
Who said that they wouldn't? I'll tell you some funny story that happened to me a few months back. When Netanyahu said that he hit the map of Greater Israel and he was thinking about it, it clearly showed that nearly half of Saudi Arabia was gone from that land. And I was asked a question by one of the Arab media outlets. And I said, I don't know why the Saudis don't want us to actually exist and they call us terrorists, but if Netanyahu takes over Mecca, would they actually fight to defend their land? And instead of the Saudis basically attacking Netanyahu over what he said, they attacked me. They considered that I was hoping that the Israelis would take over Israeli and the Saudi territory. So at the end of the day, so long as the Arabs fight one another at any point, the Israelis will just sit back and relax and basically just feel more sedition and watch us basically finish each other before they move. The Israelis will move over to take over more land. And if they don't control the land, they don't have to control the land. You have to understand, Greater Israel doesn't necessarily mean that the Israelis will have physical presence on the ground to control. What they can do is basically change the regime, change governments, or basically just install a puppet leadership that they can control, and then basically they will work with Iraq and Syria. And at the end of the day, I would say something, I want to just rectify this notion. The Israeli entity is not a state under international law. Technically, it needs to have fixed borders with people on that land governed by a political body. They do have the people and they have the political body, but they don't have fixed borders. They still don't have fixed borders with Lebanon, and they still don't have fixed borders with Syria. That's why they are pushing Lebanon to sign a treaty to actually redemarcate our land borders to fit their whims. And same thing with Syria. That's why they're taking more land at the moment before they sign over anything. They occupied 700 kilometers squared since the beginning of this year until now. And nobody has said anything from Syrian, southern Syrian territory. So, when I look at the whole situation, we do have a rogue regime that's enabled by the international community to take over more land from around its neighbors. And whenever those neighbors try to signal, they will fall in touch.
Alright, we're out of time for the show right now. Baker, just quickly, if you may, 30 seconds or less about the health of the status quo change with the all-out support from Washington and most of all, the lack of accountability for Israeli crimes in the region.
Israel's criminal impulses are financed, supported by the collective West. Without that, they could not act actions they do, and that's the bitter reality. All the actions of that is a worldwide movement which is designed to say, across the region that will take the form of armed struggle with popular movements, but also around the world in America, Germany, and etc. Growing resentment and anger towards has led to thousands of arrests in Britain, thousands of arrests in the so-called terrorism legislation. The mood is there.
Can I see for tonight's show? Thanks, Taxis and Commentator. Nick, thank you for joining us from Glasgow. Also, thanks to Journalism Political Commentator Leila Hatoum. Speaking to us from the London Snap Theater. Special thanks to you for staying with us on the show Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Greetings from Iran Radio. Let's do a swift run through of what's coming up next. We're happy to share these programs with you, so please keep listening.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces kill more women and children on the Gaza Strip as the nation's violations of the ceasefire agreement continue unabated. And Iran strongly condemns the deadly terrorist attack in Australia, saying terror violence and mass killing must be condemned regardless of where they happen. Hello everyone, thank you for joining. In today's top story, a senior Hamas official has slammed Israel's frequent violations of the Gaza ceasefire agreement, which have claimed the lives of hundreds of Palestinian civilians so far. Osama Hamdan said Israel's truce violations have left more than 400 Palestinians, mostly women and children, dead since the agreement entered into force. He stressed that the movement reserves the right to respond to the occupation's violations. Hamdan noted that Hamas is in contact with the mediators regarding negotiations for the second phase of the ceasefire, but the Israeli regime is doing its best to sabotage it. He also pointed to the deployment of an international force in Gaza. Hamdan says such a force must only act as a guarantor for the implementation of the ceasefire agreement without any authority or contact with the Palestinian people in Gaza. He stressed that Palestinians hold the internationally recognized right to resistance, especially armed resistance. The official said resistance is a purely Palestinian popular decision, not a decision of Hamas. Our correspondent Robert Ildekash joined us earlier to discuss the future of the Gaza ceasefire agreement amid repeated Israeli violations.
It's not really a ceasefire in the literal sense of that phrase. What it is a glorified pause. The Israelis needed a pause for a number of reasons. This came down to the growing PR front, the European and Arab Initiative, which was launched at the United Nations General Assembly, whereby Saudi Arabia and France had put forth their New York Declaration on a Palestinian state. And a number of different diplomatic issues that they were facing. The United States saw this, presented a counterproposal, and also saw that the Israelis were failing to achieve their goals militarily on the ground, or at least their stated goals militarily on the ground through Gideon's chariots, one, and then the second part to that operation, both of which proved to be failures. So Israel wanted to